Meeting of the 2007 session. I want to welcome everyone here in the room. We're going to have a great presentation today from the courts. But I wanted to start out today, since it is our first meeting, with an introduction of our committee and staff members. And I think we'll start at this end with Senator Prezansky.
And Madam Chair, what do you want us to share?
Well, I would like you to share your little biographical information, and I would also like you to say the most surprising thing that you think about yourself, Senator Prezansky. Thank you for asking.
Oh, no. Surprising. I'll have to talk a long time to figure out what that surprising thing is. Floyd Prezansky, my district that I represent is Senate District 4, which takes in parts of Lane and Douglas County with a very small sliver of Coons County. My legislative experience, 7 years in the House, starting my first full 4-year term in the Senate, had 3 years, 1 year as an appointed, and then 2 years after a special election in 2002, I guess it was, no, 2004. And my day job is as a prosecutor, have served in a prosecuting capacity since 1987. Currently working, because of my work in the legislature, I'm limited to doing work for municipal entities, since I can't be in the district attorney's office because of conflict of interest. And separation of power, I guess I should say. So I currently work with the City of Florence, City of Eugene, and then pick up some other work. And it's a wonderful opportunity to be here again. And my surprise is that the good Senator Cruz is on our committee.
You avoided that one, Senator Prezansky. Senator Beyer, you cannot get away with that.
Roger Beyer, Senate District 9, which is eastern Clackamas, eastern Marion, and eastern Linn counties. I served 4 years in the House prior to this, and I'm in my second term in the Senate, so at the end of this term I'll be 12 years in the legislature. This is my fourth sentence to the Judiciary Committee. My surprise, I guess, would be that I'm sitting in the vice chair seat of the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you. Why don't we go to you, Senator Cruz?
Senator Cruz, I'm Senate District 1, which is portions of Douglas, Jackson, Josephine, Coos, and all of Curry counties. And I've been in the legislature since 97, 4 terms in the House. This is my first term in the Senate, second half of my first term. I suppose my biggest surprise relative to here is that when I was talking to the Senate President, because I've been involved in health care and natural resources and education, which I still am, was that I actually asked him if I could serve on this committee, because when I went into the meeting I didn't intend on doing that. So but it led to a very interesting conversation, because if you ask Peter Courtney about judiciary, he brightens up and will give you about a 20-minute lecture so on how wonderful judiciary is. But I'm really thrilled to be here.
Thank you. And I'm Jenny Burdick. I represent a district that includes downtown Portland, Tigard, most of King City, and part of Bull Mountain in Washington and Multnomah counties. This is my sixth session. 1997 was my first session. And unlike Senator Cruz, I was scrabbling and screaming to get on judiciary from the very beginning. Got here in my second session, have been here ever since, and am incredibly honored to be chairing this committee. In my day job, I do public relations consulting work, specializing in crisis management, work with a lot of lawyers, because crisis usually involves legal issues as well. So I get my full fill of legal issues both here and in my day job. I have a daughter who just started college, which has been quite an adjustment. And my biggest surprise, I guess, is that I once worked for an oil company. So with that, I will turn this over to, and we have Senator Walker here, and when she comes, we will let her introduce herself. But for the meantime, I'll turn it over to Bill Taylor, and you can introduce the staff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bill Taylor, and I'm starting my 11th session with the legislature, and the big surprise is I still enjoy it. And to my left is Darian Stanford, and I'll let Darian talk about himself, and then we'll go to Matt Cullen.
I'm Darian Stanford. I am counsel with the Judiciary Committee, like Bill. I worked for a law firm for a while, and then most recently for a couple of years with Multnomah County DA's office to hear. I guess surprising thing is that I have continued to, in my professional career, take jobs that pay less and less. So I'm on my way to a monastery, ultimately. Right.
Is this on?
Matt, why don't you come up here so people in the audience can enjoy your presentation? We're all waiting for your surprise.
Hi, I'm Matt Kalmanson. I'm counsel with Bill and Darian for the House and Senate Judiciary Committees. After law school, I worked for a state Supreme Court justice in New Jersey and then for a Ninth Circuit judge in Portland. And since then, I've done civil law and trial and appellate courts, mostly for corporations, some individuals. And I am honored to assist the committee in any way that I can. Oh, surprising thing about me, the six-week-old at home, and that the body can go this long without sleep is very surprising to me.
If I can add something, both Matt and Darian worked together at one time. Do you know what Stallridge? Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were you there at the same time?
Yeah, I outranked you, didn't I?
That's surprising to me, too.
Yeah, that's surprising.
We've had a lawsuit filed against us for taking too many of their employees, but we're dealing with it.
In addition, we have in the audience Miranda Plummer, who's a third-year law student from University of Oregon Law School. She'd be helping us out 3 days a week. Miranda, could you stand up?
Okay.
Why don't you come up here?
Oh, so.
Hi, I'm Miranda Plummer. I'm a third-year law student at University of Oregon. Obviously, I haven't started working at the firm that these gentlemen have worked at, but last summer I worked with Judge Schuman at the Court of Appeals, and looking forward to working with the Judiciary Committee. I guess my surprising thing is that I made it from Eugene this morning without getting into an accident.
Wow.
Thank you, Miranda.
We also have Kate Toswell in the audience. Kate is with Legislative Counsel's Office, and she's primarily responsible for drafting in the criminal justice area, the juvenile justice area.
Hi, I'm Kate Toswell. I'm from Legislative Counsel. I'm a deputy legislative counsel, and I primarily draft in the areas of crime, corrections, state police, and then a couple other related areas like investigators and polygraphs, for one. And this is my first session. I started in July. And before this, I practiced primarily in the area of criminal law for 10 years, most recently in private practice in Portland, and before that in New York City. And my biggest surprise is that since July, I've actually mastered the drafting system in Legislative Council, which is a very old and arcane computer system.
We are aware of that, especially those of us who've served on Legislative Council.
Okay, could you introduce you, another person?
And also with me is Josh Nasby, who is a staff attorney in Legislative Council and is drafting in the area of criminal law and I believe also taxation.
We'll let you off with a wave, Josh. Uh-huh.
In the back of the room is Ellen Osinich. And Ellen, you're going to have to help me pronouncing the last name. Ellen is out of the Multnomah County DA's office and helping with another committee, and we're doing our darndest to recruit her to help us out for Judiciary Committee.
We'll let you by with a wave, too. Yeah. Thanks, Ellen. Okay, and then Patsy.
Excuse me, Patsy Wood. Who's been what number session is this, Patsy?
Five.
And if you could introduce the...
Jen Black, working Senate Judiciary this session, and Sarah Campbell will be working on the House side, but they may interchange, so I wanted you to meet both of them.
Thank you. And this session, I have the great fortune to actually have a lawyer on my personal staff, Natasha Dolezal. And Natasha, I'll let you get by with a wave, too. Just passed the bar, graduated from Lewis and Clark College and School of Law, and I'm very glad to have her on board. Our Senate president told me some time ago, he said, you know, when I see a legislator doing great things. I always know that they have fabulous staff. And based on the introductions we've had here on our staff, I'm certainly very optimistic about the kind of work we're going to be able to do this session. So very happy to have you all here. Any more introductions? Okay. We will now move to the adoption of committee rules, Council.
Chair, members of the committee, you have the committee rules before you. They are the same rules that are before all the other committees of the Senate. And I believe there is significantly similar to what we had last year.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
I move adoption of the committee rules as proposed.
Senator Beyer has moved adoption of the committee rules as proposed. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you. Now it is our great pleasure to welcome the judges from the Oregon Court of Appeals and the Honorable Virginia Linder from the Oregon Supreme Court to give us some instruction on statutory interpretation. I've been through this presentation a couple of times. I don't think I've ever been through it when I haven't learned at least three or four things that I've never even thought of before. So I want to welcome you very warmly. And I will let Judge Brewer, Judge Landauer, Justice Kistler, and Judge Schumann determine the order and how you want to proceed. Thank you. Judge Brewer. And if you could, of course, introduce yourself for the record.
On open an informational meeting?
I don't think we need to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dave Brewer. I'm the Chief Judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals. And I have my colleagues with me, Judge Jack Landau of the Court of Appeals, and now Justice Linder, formerly of the Court of Appeals, now of the Oregon Supreme Court. It's our pleasure to be back this year, and we know we're talking to a very experienced Senate Judiciary Committee who is quite familiar with many of the things that we're going to be talking about today, and we don't want this to be simply a rehash of anything any of you have heard before. More than anything else, we want it to be part of an ongoing conversation that I think the judiciary has to have with the legislature, and part of a continuing conversation that we in the courts have with you in the legislature throughout this session. We want to be available to you, be helpful to you, and not give in the way. And so what I'd like to do just for a moment to set the stage for this this discussion is the three of us are planning on, with the indulgence of the committee, talking to you for approximately 1 hour about the issue of statutory construction, to be followed by a panel consisting of Justice Kistler and Judge Schumann, who will be talking to you about constitutional law issues. As far as we're concerned, we want you to interrupt us and talk to us about things on your mind, particularly if what we're saying is a little off the point for you. We hope it won't be, but please make sure you know that's an open invitation. Why are we starting out by talking about statutory construction? Well, maybe just a little background about the Court of Appeals will put that in perspective. As many of you know, and I've said this several times before, the Court of Appeals hears about 3,500 to 4,000 appeals per year, considers that many cases. And that makes us, per case, per judge, just about the busiest appellate court in the United States. Of those cases, our estimate is about 2/3 to 70% involve some issue relating to statutory construction. So by volume, this becomes one of the most prolific areas of appellate review. And so we think it has that kind of primacy. The other thing I'd say is one of the most frustrating parts of communication for any groups is talking to each other indirectly after the fact. And I think historically that's what the courts and the legislature have done. Legislature enacts statutes, case comes up through the courts, through litigation, through the trial courts, and eventually some issue involving the interpretation of the statute may come up years later. The courts hear the arguments of the parties, review the case, issue an opinion about the statutes published in reports. We don't necessarily talk to you about it. Your legislative council may read it. Somebody may look at it and say, what were those folks thinking? And what we're trying to avoid is that kind of communication, which can be so frustrating for everybody, but instead talk to you today about several bullet points of things where we think it might be useful you know how we think and how we construe your statutes, and to have you give us some feedback on that as well. So for that purpose, we've got a handout. Some of you have seen this before. We've updated it a little bit. I want to just start out by saying most of the rules about how courts construe statutes come from the legislature. They're based on statutes you've enacted in ORS Chapter 174. And what the three of us have done is made copies of the primary statutes you've given us, which we take as our field manual in how to interpret your statutes, and printed them out for you. And several of them will be discussed today in our presentation. So that's a handout we think you might find useful. As we divide the work today, Judge Landau is going to take the laboring oar in talking about the statutory construction principles. Then we're going to ask Justice Linder to give sort of a common sense judge's view about how these rules actually get applied. And then we're going to interact with you and each other with any questions you have. Let me just take a moment, please, and introduce the three of us. As I said, I'm the Chief Judge of the Court, have been since late 2004. My background is in private practice in Eugene, where I was an attorney for 16 years, focusing on civil litigation and business. So I come from a business law background. After that, I spent 6 years on the Lane County Circuit Court as a trial judge, so I had that trial court experience, and then have now been on the Court of Appeals for 8 years. Seated to my right is Judge Jack Landau. Judge Landau is a presiding judge of one of the three panels of this court. He's a graduate. He's an Oregonian. He's a graduate of Franklin High School, Lewis and Clark College, Northwestern School of Law at Lewis and Clark. He's got an advanced law degree from the University of Virginia. He served as a judge on our court now for almost 15 years. Before that, he had extensive experience in private practice and served as Deputy Attorney General for the state of Oregon. And he's one of the very top scholars in Oregon and teachers in the area of statutory construction. He teaches the course on that topic at Willamette University College of Law, and he'll take the lead in our presentation. Justice Linder, just elected by the people of the state to the Oregon Supreme Court, and we're so very proud of her. She is a graduate of Southern Oregon University, also an Oregonian, Willamette University College of Law. She served on the Court of Appeals from 1997 until the end of this last year. Before that, she also had a very illustrious career in the Attorney General's office, capping that career as Oregon's top appellate lawyer, the Solicitor General. Like Judge Landau, she's a very clear and careful thinker and writer, and as I said, she'll briefly describe the overall approach that appellate judges take in tackling these problems. And again, this is, for us, a dialogue, not just talking heads, so please treat it that way. And with that preface, I'll turn things over to my friend Judge Landau.
Thank you, Chief. Madam Chair, members of the committee, at the outset, I feel compelled to say I didn't work for Stoll Reeves. I want to add my thanks for the invitation to come talk to you. I just finished my class just about a half an hour ago at Willamette, and one of the things we talked about was the kind of dialogue. Law professors often refer to it as a dialogue between the courts and the legislature through the enactment of statutes and then the interpretation by the courts and then a response by the statute. And it is a dialogue of sorts in a sort of abstract way. But what I was really pleased to report to my class is that we get to have a real dialogue. And we're really grateful for the invitation to come here and actually talk face-to-face about where our work intersects. And this is the point, this statutory construction stuff that we will be talking today about, this is the point where our work and your work cross paths, and so it seems real appropriate for us to spend some time together and have this conversation about the rules by which we construe the material that you enact into law. Now, sitting here and looking out at you, I recognize that some of you have heard this before, so it will be review for some of you. It won't be for some others, but I want to encourage you, as the Chief did, please interrupt with questions. I love this stuff. I can talk about it all day. It's really interesting. It's really important to me. I'm frankly very proud of the work that the courts do and proud of the way that the legislature and the Oregon courts work in this process. And so if you don't stop me with some questions, I'll just, you know, keep going on, and that's probably not good for everybody. As Chief Judge Brewer explained, we are the state's appellate courts. Judge Brewer and I are on the Court of Appeals, and that means we hear cases from every corner of the state on pretty much every subject imaginable. Everything except death penalty and taxation is just about it. In general, though, it's important to understand what we do is we review decisions of the trial courts and of administrative agencies to make sure that they applied the law correctly. We're commonly what's referred to as an error-correcting court. We're trying to make sure that the lower courts and the agencies didn't make errors of a sufficient magnitude that requires us to reverse the decision outright or to reverse it and send it back for a new trial or a new hearing. Our job is to make sure that folks follow the law. Then we explain our decisions in written opinions. The reason I focus on that is that what I'd like is for you to understand that we understand that our job is not making law. That's not our primary job. That's your primary job. And we're very happy with that relationship. Our job is not to make policy. Our job is to determine what the policy is that you enacted into law and to ensure that lower courts and administrative agencies are following that as you intended it. So what is the law that we have to determine whether people properly apply? First, there is federal law. The federal law refers to the federal constitution, federal statutes, federal regulations. I will not take much time with that because Judge Schuman and Justice Kistler will talk more about that. But just to give you an example, during the last session, in fact, the United States Supreme Court decided that certain administrative rules governing the sentencing of criminal offenders were unconstitutional because they permitted trial judges to impose additional periods of incarceration or supervision based on findings that the judges make and not juries. And the United States Supreme Court determined as a matter of federal constitutional law that you can't do that. Well, our sentencing guideline scheme looked an awful lot like the Washington scheme that the United States Supreme Court declared unconstitutional. So when it came time for us to review the Oregon sentencing guidelines, we and ultimately the Oregon Supreme Court followed suit. It did not matter whether we think that the U.S. Supreme Court was correct or whether we think it was a good idea. It's federal law, and that's the end of it. And so that's the way it works in our federal scheme. Fortunately, few of our cases actually involve federal law. By far and away, the bulk of the work that we do involves state law. State law generally refers to one of four things. It refers to the constitution of the state. It refers to statutes that you enact. It refers to administrative agency regulations that are promulgated by executive branch agencies, and it refers to court-made law. The first one I'll talk about just briefly, the state constitution, which includes everything that was in the original 1857 constitution and any amendments that have been enacted since that time, essentially allocates power between the three branches of government and then describes limits on how that power can be exercised. There are limits on the way we can exercise the judicial power. There are limits on the way you can exercise the legislative power. There are limits on the way the governor can exercise the executive power. So, for example, the legislature cannot constitutionally enact a statute that imposes one criminal sentence if you are a black offender and a different criminal sentence if you are a white offender and all the facts otherwise are the same. Article 1, Section 20 would preclude that. That's a limitation on the legislature's authority. I think that's pretty pretty straightforward. And again, Judge Schuman and Justice Kistler will elaborate on that. More important for our purposes, state law refers to the legislation that you enact. It refers to those 17 volumes of Oregon revised statutes that cover everything from abandoned property to zoning. Those statutes represent your collective wisdom about what is the best public policy for the citizens of the state of Oregon. As long as that judgment doesn't violate one of the constitutional limitations on the exercise of legislative power, it's the law, it binds us, and it binds everybody that is subject to its terms. Our job is to determine what that law means and, again, whether lower courts and administrative agencies have followed it. What we need to do is talk about how we go about making that happen. What are the rules by which we determine what the statutes mean? Usually, it's pretty straightforward. I've been a student of legislation and statutory construction for a number of years now, and I have to say the work of the Oregon legislature is head and shoulders above the work of many, many other states and certainly the federal government. If you have any questions about that, just I dare you, open up at random any provision of the Internal Revenue Code. You'll feel wonderful about the work that you do. It is crystal clear in comparison. The problem is that in some cases, and you know, there are, as Dave said, we have 3,000, 4,000 cases a year. There are 100 or 200 of those a year that do involve ambiguities in the statutes. Those ambiguities sometimes come from mistakes in drafting. They come from cases in which the legislature enacts a statute to address one problem, and you know what? The language is arguably broad enough to cover something the legislature might not even thought about, and the question is whether it extends to that. Sometimes it just has to do with the ambiguity of language. Sometimes language just isn't as clear as we like to think it is. I know that's certainly been my experience in my own opinion drafting. So what we have to do is figure out what those statutes mean. We do that by means of rules. The rules come from one of two places. The first are the rules that you enact into law, and that's what we've handed out in the sheets of paper that you have. They're excerpts from Chapter 174 of the Oregon Revised Statutes. Those are a collection of rules that have been adopted by the legislature over the course of the last 150 years. Some of them actually date back to 1862 in the original Deedy Code. Some of them are as recent as, I think, two or three legislative sessions ago. Those govern our review of your legislative enactments. In addition to those rules, we have our own rules that have been developing over centuries dealing with the meaning of words and word order, canons of construction, and so forth, and we'll talk about those in just a minute. The basic objective of statutory construction is one that's described in the rules that you enacted. And if you look at, I think it's 174.020, that says that the object of statutory construction is to pursue the intention of the legislature if possible. That is critical for all of us to understand. Our job is to figure out what you mean when you enact statutes. It is not what we think would be a better way to interpret the statutes. It's not what we think the law should be. Our job, and we take this very seriously, is to determine what you intended the law to mean. We do that by essentially a three-step process that was very nicely laid out by the Oregon Supreme Court back in 1993 in a case, PGE versus Bureau of Labor and Industries. And if you talk to lawyers about statutory construction, you'll have a tough time having a conversation without somebody referring to PGE at some point. We are required by that three-step process of statutory construction to look first and foremost at the words of the statute. And this is the most important thing that we'll talk about today, is the words of the statute limit what we can do in determining what it is you intended the statute to mean. We can implement your intentions only if you give us the words to work with. If there's nothing else you remember from what I'm saying today, that would be it, is we have to have words in the statute that can be reasonably construed to effectuate the intentions that you wish. If the legislature, for example, accidentally leaves a section out, there's nothing we can do to put that section back in. Right? That is not because we're excessively polite or because we're cautious. It's because we don't have the authority to do that. Again, if you look at the statutes that the legislature enacted, one of them very specifically says that the office of the judge is to ascertain and declare what is, in terms or in substance, contained in that statute, not to insert what's been omitted or to omit what's been inserted. That's probably one of the most quoted statutes in statutory construction. We take it pretty seriously. So if it's not there, we can't put it in there. And if it is there, we can't ignore it. We have to give effect to the language that's there. Most of the time, the words are there. And the question is, what do those words mean? In deciding what words mean, we follow a couple of principles. To begin with, we will conclude that words mean whatever you say they mean. So if you want the words of a statute to mean something in particular, all you have to do is say so. There are definition sections in the statutes, and if you want, for example, the term motor vehicle to include motorized skateboards, all you have to do is say that. We actually had a case on that once. All you have to do is say motorized vehicles includes automobiles and motorized skateboards. If you don't include a definition, then what we have to do is try to figure out what you most likely intended those words to mean. When we do that, we're going to assume, in the absence of evidence to the contrary, that you intend the words to mean what they ordinarily mean. Right? So what that means is we're going to look at a dictionary, because those are the common sources of ordinary meaning. In particular, we tend to rely on Webster's Dictionary, primarily, I think, because Webster's Dictionary is the kind of dictionary that reports actual usage of terms instead of what some lexicographers think words should mean. So it will report more accurately changes in meaning over time, for example. So we will look at the ordinary meaning of words if there's no definition. The problem, of course, is the definition sometimes, I mean, a dictionary can have as many as hundreds of definitions for a single term. If you look at Webster's, for example, if you look up the word set, there are 200 different definitions. My understanding is that's the word with the most different definitions. And that's not uncommon. So what we have to do is figure out which of those definitions you most likely intended. And the way we do it is we look at the way the words are used in the section. We look at the way the words are used in other sections on the same subject, other statutes, and so forth. So we're looking for clues about what you intended. So, for example, we had a case several years ago about the growing of marijuana on public lands. It's a crime, of course, to grow marijuana, but you're subject to an additional sentence if you grow the marijuana on public land. Well, what does public land mean? It was a problem in our particular case because, in this case, the defendant was in a building that was owned by a private university. It was in the basement of a lab, and he had this marijuana grow operation in the basement. It's a private building, but the building was leased from the federal government land, or it was built on federal government land. So is it on public land or is it on private land? Well, it depends. There were some definitions. Webster's, for example, defines public lands as land that's not yet been appropriated. It's unreserved and unappropriated public domain land that's open to entry and settlement. Well, if that's the case, this isn't public land. But what we did is we looked at the way that public land is used in some 200 other statutes. It wasn't defined in the criminal code, but we looked at a lot of other statutes, and consistently the legislature employed the term more broadly to mean public land is land that's owned by the state or federal government without any other restrictions. Well, if that's the case, this particular case involved public land, and that's what we held. Because you didn't have a definition, but it looked pretty clear to us from the way the legislature used that term in all these other statutes. There was no indication that the legislature intended to use it differently, and so that was our way of trying to get at what you most likely intended, you institutionally, that statute meant.
Jack, and that particular search for clues in other related provisions or other parts of ORS where the same term is used is called a search for context, right?
Right.
Start with the text, then go to the context.
Senator Walker?
Thank you. Judge Landau, it seemed to me as you were talking about that case that you were put to a lot of extra work because we didn't do our job. And then I got to thinking about, well, we didn't do our job, but we also have drafters who draft the legislation. And for most of us, we don't think about trying to define a term. And our drafters are kind of responsible for that as well. Do you have this conversation with the people who draft our laws down in Legislative Council?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, that's a great observation. And in fact, yes, I've been invited over the years on a number of occasions by Legislative Council to actually sit down and have lunch with Legislative Council and talk about legislative drafting problems that we routinely see in the courts so that they can draft statutes to avoid them. We've, over the years, had a great relationship with Legislative Council and obviously a mutual interest in seeing that legislative drafting is as clear as possible. I wouldn't go so far, though, as to say that you fell down on the job. I mean, it's really impossible to anticipate when you're in the thick of debating a particular mm-hmm. statute which of those terms is going to end up being the one that precipitates a disagreement. I mean, theoretically, you could define everything. It's a safe thing to assume that not everything needs to be defined. Where you draw the line, you know, you do the best you can. I always encourage Legislative Council, if you have any reason to believe that there's going to be a term that will be important substantively, go ahead and define it. Just mm-hmm. take away any kind of possibility of doubt about what the legislature intended. Just be safe.
A follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you. And you're right. I mean, I wouldn't have thought that I needed to define public land. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't think that I would need to define what an automobile is. But in certain cases now, today, you would have to because there are new technologies and new changes. So I guess it's just something I'll start being a little more aware of. Having been working in the courts for 23 years, I see this, but, you know, I make the laws and my judges enforce them.
Yeah.
So if I don't do a very good job, they have a very difficult time interpreting it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions so far? Okay. If we, most of the time, we are able to determine what the legislature intended the words to mean by looking at the definitions, by looking at the way the words are used in context. Most of the time it's pretty clear. And if you look at our cases, by far and away most of those cases are resolved at that first level of analyzing the text. But sometimes a case can't be resolved with just looking at a dictionary and looking at the way the words are used in the sentence. So what we do is we proceed to a second step and we look at legislative history. When we look at legislative history, what we're trying to do is resolve an ambiguity. And for us, that's a term of art. What it means is we're facing a statute that reasonably could mean more than one thing. Because if it could reasonably only mean one thing, we're done. We figured out what you intended, right? So if we can identify the possibility that it could mean one or two or three different things and we can't resolve it, then we'll look to the legislative history to see which of those three things you most likely intended the statute to mean. The important thing there is that legislative history isn't a substitute for drafting in the statute itself. It just, if you look at the cases, it doesn't work to try to, in effect, amend a statute by just inserting a legislative history into the work session. You need to change the words of the statute. Let me give you an example of how we resolve the ambiguity. It's a fun case that we actually had a couple of years ago. There's a statute that makes it a crime to alter a license plate on a car. and it defines the term alteration. Alteration means any frame or placeholder that obscures the numbers, the letters, or the registration stickers on the license plate. Well, that seems clear enough. Until you think about what happens when you get one of those little license plate holders that says, you know, I'd rather be shopping, right? And it covers up the word Oregon. Well, that's what happened in our case, was that the defendant had one of those little license plate holders and it covered up the word Oregon. It did not obscure the six-digit identification number on the license plate, but it did the word Oregon, and the person was charged with violating the alteration statute. What we had to figure out was whether that's what the statute meant. Well, if you look at on the face of it, it reasonably could mean only the identification marks. Because that's, think about it, that's probably what the statute was about. On the other hand, just taking it at face value, it is very broadly defined. It obscures the numbers, letters, or registration stickers, and in this case, the word Oregon has letters in it, and those letters were obscured. So to be safe, we looked at the legislative history, and in the legislative history, it became very clear to us that what the legislature was concerned about was covering up that six-digit identification mark and not the other extraneous words around the edge of the license plate. And so we said, no, it has to obscure, you know, the ABC 123 so that when the police officer comes up behind the car, the police officer doesn't have any problem identifying, you know, who the car is owned by.
Thank you. I may be anticipating you, but when you talk about legislative history, that includes an awful lot of stuff. Could you just very briefly go over the hierarchy of what legislative history is? I know you start out with the carrying statement and then you work your way down. If you could just briefly summarize that hierarchy, if that's not where you're already headed. Thanks.
Madam Chair, that's a great question. In a nutshell, legislative history is anything that is generated during the enactment process. Basically, anything we can find in the bill file and archives, right, that sheds light on what the legislature intended the words of the statute to mean. Typically, what that will include is the various drafts of the bill as it works its way through the process, because sometimes we can glean what you intend from the wording changes. As there are amendments that are tossed around, we can identify what you were intending by what happens to those amendments. Any statements of legislators, any statements of witnesses, lobbyists, state agency representatives in committee hearings, any comments and amendments during the work session, any debates and comments on the House or Senate floor. If there's a conference committee, if there are any kind of formal reports, those don't happen too often in our legislative process, but there are any kind of formal legislative committee reports beyond the one-page summaries that staff often prepare, that's also part of it. In terms of a hierarchy, we will, you know, there's so little legislative history in the scheme of things because there's so much time pressure in the Oregon legislative session. We don't have the luxury like folks in Congress do of having these, you know, reams and reams of committee reports that get printed overnight and are on your desk the next day. We'll look at anything that reasonably sheds light on what you intended the statute to mean. But having said that, we tend to give less weight to statements of lobbyists. That's not because lobbyists aren't good people. When I was in private practice, I appeared before the legislature in my capacity as a lobbyist, and I considered it an important part of the process to provide information. But at the same time, you know, when we look at this information, we want to know what you intended. And it's a rather indirect route to draw inferences from what a lobbyist who is in favor or in opposition to a bill, what those people are saying. It's kind of a stretch for us to draw inferences about your intentions. So when in the past when my friends have asked me, my friends in the legislature, you know, how best to get our attention in cases like that, my advice is if there's something that a lobbyist or an state agency representative says that you find particularly helpful, what's helpful for us is for you to say that on the record. That's a huge help. So if somebody says, you know, if the Department of Justice drafts a bill or the Department of Environmental Quality or somebody, and the agency representative gives you the background and tells you what the agency intended in drafting that, and that coincides with your understanding and you find that helpful, it really helps us if that's on the record. And we will give much greater weight to the statement of the non-legislator witnesses. Okay, that's...
If we put it on the record ourselves.
Right, right.
Let me give you another, for instance. Let's say we pass a bill out of this committee and I'm Senator Byers carrying the bill on behalf of the committee. Let's say it has to do with methamphetamine, just for a quick example. And it's on the Senate floor and Senator Byers says the intent is to increase the penalties for meth cooks. And Senator Cruz, who's also a member of the committee, stands up and says, no, he voted no in committee because it really won't work. You get this statute, and it's fuzzy to you what the intent is. Whose statement counts more, Senator Beyer, who's carrying the bill, or Senator Cruz, who's objecting to it?
Madam Chair, that's a real tough question. We will, depending on the circumstances of each case, look at whatever we think is most likely reflective of what the institution as a whole thought was going on. As a rule, that generally means that the people who are on the side, on the prevailing side, are more likely to be given weight than the people who opposed the legislation or the amendments at issue. There may be also a tendency to give more credence to somebody who, for example, has been designated by the chair to carry the bill on the floor. That person is always given extra weight in looking at floor statements. If somebody was the sponsor of the measure, or somebody has some special expertise to bring to bear, the courts will always pay attention to that.
That leads to my next question. I don't mean to disrupt your presentation here because we are getting a little tight on time. But that leads to the next question is, what advice would you have? We send several hundred bills out of this committee, and we have carriers for all those bills. As a person who's charged with interpreting these, what advice would you have to the carriers of the bills out of this and other committees?
A brief statement about what the legislature intended to accomplish by the bill is always helpful. In particular, what is the problem that precipitated the enactment of the bill? That's always helpful to us. If we know what was the problem that caused somebody to bring this to your attention in the first place, what are you trying to solve? Because sometimes that's all we have to go on in determining what the language means. If there's particular language that was the subject of debate in committee, you might want to talk about how you resolve that when you talk about it on the floor. The most important thing is just to be clear. My favorite example is one that Representative Mannix offered when he was in the legislature. He drafted a bill designed to respond to one of our decisions. And when he was on the floor, he actually said, let's state for the record what it says here. First, this will do away with the current court interpretations of what is a new injury for responsibility purposes, a workers' compensation case. Do you hear that, judges of the Court of Appeals of the Workers' Compensation Board? When you read the transcript of that hearing, this does away with what you've been saying. We were not in the least bit offended by that. I like the idea of there being a real clear statement. That means I'm going to get it right when I see something like that in the record. And in fact, the Oregon Supreme Court quoted that in Safe versus Drews in deciding that that's what the statute meant.
Jack, can I mention one other thing? Sorry, with you, Madam Chair, that might be a good rule of thumb to follow here. Judge Landau focused on the legislature, the carrier, indicating what the bill is intended to accomplish. There may be times as well that you're deliberately not trying to do something else. And so if there's a knot in your intent and you're conscious of that, don't forget the knot.
Just to bring this to a close.
Sorry, just before we leave the subject.
Senator Cruz.
So a floor speech carries more weight than stuff we put on record in committee?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I'm personally real hesitant to say that because
you know, we got a real clear statement in committee, sometimes that can be really great stuff and may be more persuasive than a more ambiguous statement on the floor. It's really going to depend on the circumstances. The Oregon courts tend not to have as rigid a hierarchy of legislative history as you might see in some of the federal cases, for example. In the federal cases, you know, floor statements rank very low in the scheme of things. But here, if we've got a clear floor statement, that could be dispositive. If we have a real clear statement in committee and it appears to reflect the will of the committee, that can also be really, really helpful to us.
I mean, in this forum here, I would think there would be times if there's things we want not to do and things we want to be really clear on, if we're, you know, for the record and then do it, and then Mr. Taylor can make sure we get it right, or we can all kind of chime in. It might make it clearer for you guys than sometimes we get into stuff and nonsense on the floor. So,
right.
Well, I assume there's also a timing element here too, which is, you know, when you're in committee, you're in an early stage, and someone may express an opinion, and then the train may move in another direction. And so I would assume that it's that you go from more recency to farther back in the discussion.
Madam Chair, that's exactly right. Often you'll see the courts say that the later in the process, the more likely whatever is said will be representative of the intentions of the legislature. But having said that, it does depend on the case. I mean, Oregon's legislative system is very committee-centered. Because of that, if you look at the cases, you'll see an awful lot of attention paid to what is stated in committee.
That's interesting. Counsel?
Hey, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Judge Landauer talked about what is the problem. In the staff measure ceremony, we will address what the problem is. Now, it's our statement, but if you were to paraphrase that or use that in your speech, that would go a long way in establishing not only the my statement, Darian's statement, and our recollection of what happened in the committee, but that would solidify even more on the floor as to what the problem is. And the staff measure summary also talks as to what the solution is, too.
For the record, I'm seeing nodding heads from the judges.
Yeah. Let me just wrap this up by reference to the third step in the statutory construction process.
That's okay.
He took a bye.
Okay, I'll pass. We look at the text and the context. If it's clear, we'll stop. If it's not, we'll look at the legislative history. Sometimes the legislative history doesn't help us, most often because the problem that we're looking at just isn't something that the legislature anticipated. As we said, you can't anticipate all the possible applications of the statute. And in that case, we go to a third level where we have a collection of canons or rules of construction that are more or less tiebreakers, because we don't have anything else to go to. We don't have the luxury, if we're stuck with a really ambiguous statute, we don't have the luxury of simply saying, gosh, you know, just beats the heck out of me what this means, and send it back to you. We have cases that require us to determine that somebody wins and somebody loses depending on what the statutes mean, so we need some kind of tiebreakers, and we have a series of rules. So, for example, if you have competing constructions and one of them would be arguably unconstitutional and the other wouldn't, we will always give the legislature the benefit of the doubt and say we assume the legislature didn't intend to enact something that's even arguably unconstitutional. If we have a statute that, you know, might arguably lead to an absurd result and one that wouldn't, again, we'll give the legislature the benefit of the doubt and assume that the legislature intended the less absurd, just as a matter of common sense. Quick example of that, we had a case not long ago involving the possession of a controlled substance, which requires that there be knowing possession. In that particular case, the defendant knew that she possessed an illegal substance. It happened to be meth, but she thought it was cocaine. And her argument was, I didn't know it was cocaine. And ultimately, we said, look, maybe in the abstract, you could say knowing could refer to one or the other, but common sense tells us that if you know it's an illegal substance, it doesn't matter that you misidentified it as cocaine instead of meth or vice versa.
That's pretty good.
Write an opinion about that. So in a nutshell, we have the object of statutory construction to determine what you intended the words of the statute to mean. We will be limited in that exercise by the words that you actually enact. We'll look for your definitions. We will, if we can't find definitions, assume that you intended the words to mean what they ordinarily mean. If we can't determine your intentions from that, we'll look at the legislative history. If we can't determine from legislative history, then we'll look at a series of canons or maxims or rules of construction to break the tie. I hope this gives you a clearer picture of the work of the Court of Appeals, of the appellate courts generally, and its decisions about your handiwork, statutes in particular. We hope that if we can help you better understand the rules that govern our work in carrying out your intentions, that we can make your jobs a little bit easier in developing legislation that clearly expresses those intentions. It's really a privilege to talk to you about this, and would entertain any questions. And if you don't,
thank you. Let me thank you very much. That was great. Let me ask you a specific what if that is an actual case. Last session, Senator Beyer and I worked very hard on a methamphetamine package that we passed through the legislature, and throughout the legislative process, the point was made over and over again that meth was a very serious issue and deserved special treatment, deserved in some cases more severe criminal penalties, and this was throughout the legislative process. We also reorganized the statute somewhat to list the criminal penalties by drug so that we can keep better statistics on what kind of drug issues we're facing in Oregon. In that process, we inadvertently increased the penalty for possession of marijuana to a higher level, to a level 6, where cocaine and heroin might be a level 4. And so that was, here you had a case in floor statements, in committee, in everything else, and elsewhere in the statute, where this was clearly not the intent, but there it is. So somebody, so it gets to you all. What do you do with something like that? And we're going to fix it. We don't want this to come back to you. But just in a case like this, if you faced a case like that, how would you weigh these things?
If there's an answer, and Jack, you can give it.
Well, I let me give you. Yeah, there are two answers. One is that's a specific case, and it could come to us, and I don't know how that would get resolved. There's a more general answer that harkens back to something I said at the outset, which is we're limited by the Constitution and by your statutes in what we can do to fix drafting mistakes. Mm-hmm. And if something accidentally gets left out, all we can do without violating the Constitution and ORS 174.010 is to say, look, here's what happened. This obviously isn't what the legislature intended. But unless there are words there that we can reasonably construe to effectuate that intention, there's just nothing we can do.
So the words trump the clear intent.
Hmm. Well, I think that's it. I mean, it's the plain, it's in the text, and if it's unfortunately mistaken, misstated, we have to live with it until we come back and fix it.
Okay. Sure. I wonder if I could make one point here, because I think your question really points out the difference in the relationship between the courts and the legislature, and by particularly pointing to the statute 174.010. Judge Landau has really hit on, I think, what the final point is we wanted to leave you with today, and that's to let Justice Lindert talk to you for a couple of minutes about how the courts over time have tried to establish a methodology from these statutes, because as you look at them, you'll see that the legislature has, as Judge Landau pointed out, enacted these over a period of many years, but they're not really a process. But what he has described is a process. So Justice Lindert could take a couple of minutes and explain that. I think it might be useful to you. It's how we bring, hopefully, some common sense to these problem-solving issues.
Great. Welcome, Justice Lindert. And I do believe this is your very first appearance as a Supreme Court justice before the legislature. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, welcome. We're glad to have you first.
On Monday.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, at least it's my first speaking appearance. thank you very much, and thank you especially for that introduction, Madam Chair. What I'm going to describe is not so much an academic approach to how courts and attorneys alike have approached these things over time. It's really anecdotal and comes from my own experience as somebody who has now been either before or on the courts for some 29 years, dealing consistently throughout that time with issues of statutory construction. I was not even a young lawyer. I was a law student in 1978 when I first began briefing cases for the Department of Justice. That was at a point when there had been several major legislative comprehensive revisions during the 70s. The criminal code was revised, the criminal procedure code was revised, the evidence code was revised, parts of the Administrative Procedures Act was revised, the juvenile code, motor vehicle code, and so on. And so, as in all things, when there are legislative changes of any kind, let alone comprehensive revisions, there is an inevitable shakedown cruise that follows that as everybody goes into the courts and tries to determine where the ambiguities in the statutes are and how they apply. Those cases came to me almost instantly as a lawyer. And at that time, I can look back now and think about how we briefed, and I personally briefed some of those cases. The approach was in many ways some of what you're hearing. We would almost inevitably look at the statute, look at the words, and begin to have the debate over the meaning because there'd be some reasonable disagreement, some ambiguity in that. But from there, the discussion went any number of directions, and sometimes it wasn't so much of a discussion as each side kind of engaging in a separate analysis. I might, for example, in a brief, know it was important to think about the meaning of a particular word, and I might simply assert in the brief what the ordinary understanding of that word was. I didn't go to a dictionary necessary to look it up. I can recall opinions where the court would say the same sort of thing without actually citing a source for it. I did often in those days, because it was on the heels of those reforms, there were people just down the hall from me in the Department of Justice who'd been on the committees that had actually come up with the major bills. I'd walk down the hall and ask a colleague what that statute meant, and then I'd go find something in the history, once I knew it was probably there, to bolster that. And it was simply a matter of looking at what are a series of common sense tools, the canons of construction, the legislative history, the plain language, other provisions of a bill. But they were used fairly opportunistically, if you will. People seized on what helped them and argued that first and clung to that. What changed with the introduction of the PGE methodology in 1993 was exactly that, a methodology. And the interpretive rules of Chapter 174 had been in place. I can honestly say I'm not sure I recall using them or seeing the court use them very much back in those days either. But there was no order prescribed in those things or in case law from the courts to tell everybody where to start and how to work our way through the process. At first, when PGE came down as a lawyer appearing before the courts, I think it felt constraining. It felt as though we were sort of being handcuffed a bit and artificially bound to the words of the statute when maybe we knew of legislative history that was out there that would be helpful. But over time, I have to say, I think that methodology, I say this as a lawyer who dealt with it, now as a judge who has been very beneficial in the sense that it has created a very constructive, coherent discussion between the attorneys that come into a courtroom instead of just glomming on to whatever little piece of the analysis that might benefit them. There's a starting point, there's a point to move to, there's a way to look at this that facilitates a discussion where people actually engage the differences and the similarities between what they see in those things.
in turn, the courts, in following that methodology as well, have to explain it in those terms in our opinions. And what I think that does in the process is it... I hope that's not me. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I'm so used to the courtroom microphone. Okay.
We get something to our mics. They never used to be this responsive.
They are. They upgraded the whole building.
What that's done from I think, the perspective of those who read and watch the court's opinions is make it tangible and express and more clear that this is not a process where we as judges are simply trying to impose our own policy preferences or our own outcomes to a statute. It's a good faith effort to work through it in a way that is designed to examine what your understanding and what your intent was. And I think the methodology in its way actually tries to begin as close to the clues of your understanding as possible, and as it works through the layers and we get to canons of construction, we're probably at that point the farthest away from the mm-hmm. direct clues. And so in that sense, it's faithful to it. At the other end of this process, I'll just quickly describe one more piece of what's a very real part of statutory construction for us. Judge Landau described that these are hard questions often, and they're hard questions as he's emphasized because of the ambiguity of human language for purposes of communication. And there are plenty of times where I think judges would be happy if we could say, darned if we know, we just don't know, we can't figure it out. But that's not an option. We do have to come down on one side of the case or another, one interpretation or another, and give it our best shot. It may mean that we aren't right. We may get it wrong sometimes. And the other question that comes up at that point is, then what? We subscribe to the principle in the courts of basic stare decisis, let the decision stand for all kinds of purposes. Once a authoritative pronouncement has come out, especially from the Oregon Supreme Court, whether it's on common law, whether it's on statutes, whether it's on administrative rules, whether it's on insurance contracts or the Constitution, we let the decision stand as precedent for future cases for the purposes of predictability, even-handedness in the law. But there are those times when we revisit decisions. Usually when we're doing that, we're looking first and foremost to the fact that we were wrong. And what if 10 years down the road we decide we were wrong about an issue of a statutory construction? Those are hard questions. The fact that the courts may have been wrong actually poses the question, doesn't answer it. It's not the case that we freely revisit it. It now poses the question, under what circumstances should we revisit it? Statutes are the one area of law where I think it's fairly uniform in the country as well as true of our own case law. That's where we are least inclined to change at least an Oregon Supreme Court decision about what a statute means, for the very reason that you are there to do it. Every 2 years when you assemble, you are in place to take a look at what the appellate courts say about the meaning of a statute, disagree with it, say we got it wrong, and fix it. But your inaction over time can be a somewhat uncertain clue as well. And that's an additional piece of that cross-section that Judge Landau was describing between what you do and what we do, where once again, in hindsight, sometimes we're trying to figure out what you may have meant if you haven't changed the statute, and we're no longer sure we were correct at some point. So I think our time is running. Let me turn it back over to the Chief, welcome any questions that you might have about that, or open it up more generally, and thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Questions from the committee?
Yeah.
Senator Cruz?
Is there anything that would preclude... Okay, you've looked at what we've done and you aren't really sure, but you've given it your best shot. And then we come back into the building. Is there anything to preclude you from coming to us and say, can you fix this so it's more clear?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I don't think anything precludes us from coming into the building and saying that. I don't know that we've done it much, but we do sometimes say it in our opinion. I think Bill Taylor probably has taken note of a few of those times over the years. We occasionally will say, at least, that some policy call is hard, or somebody may have pitched us an argument that this just doesn't make much sense, and we may think that the law is clear and it's probably something you didn't contemplate, and we'll very expressly say, this may not be the best policy, but it's not one we can fix, and you need to carry your argument over to the legislature for that purpose, that kind of thing.
But there's nothing to preclude those conversations.
I don't think so. I would say that maybe my own reluctance would be getting pulled into the policy conversation as well as the question of how to clear up the ambiguity.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm the new kid, just simple farm boy, and don't really understand any of this stuff. So, I know like one of the frustrations for me of the initiative process is that we can't get a legal opinion on the front end, which would be so incredibly helpful, but we can't. So I was just wondering if we're in a similar situation here, or if the conversations can indeed happen.
And since you did mention the initiative, I was kind of saving this to the end. I want to get through all the presentations, and then I do want to get some comment from all of you on the challenges and difficulties of interpreting initiatives in our system.
Madam Chair, I wonder if I could just say in response to the Senator's question, which is a question that plagues everyone, the reticence, Senator Cruz, that you're hearing here is an appropriate reticence, I think, not a cowardice on the part of judges, because we don't want to invade the policy province of the legislature. In other words, when we have conversations, we don't want to tell you what you should do. We want to point out decision points, problem areas, but not tell you what you should do. The other thing that limits the court's ability to go in before the fact and avoid the problem, other than the kinds of conversations we're having here today, which are really important, I think, is this. We can only decide actual cases and controversies,
right.
And that's a constitutional and a practical limitation. We can't give advisory opinions, and there are a lot of good practical reasons for that. One of the most practical reasons is that unless people are really lined up and there's an actual controversy, you're not sure you're always getting the best arguments for both sides. And we like to decide cases knowing the issues fully joint.
Mm-hmm.
For that reason, let's say two sides of the same argument presented an issue for the courts and say, go decide it. Well, we don't have an actual adversarial proceeding. And so the court's always aware the deck could be stacked there. So that restraint that you're hearing coming back from us is based on centuries of experience that tells us that the right way to decide cases is when you have a live controversy where both sides are fully pitted and exposed, rather than this sort of, you know, preemptive strike, if you will. This is as close, I think, normally as we get to having that preemptive strike, and that's why we value this discussion so much.
Madam Chair.
Senator Byer.
Senator Cruz brought up an interesting point that I was, curious about during the last year. Normally we don't get court opinions on ballot measures before they are voted on, but yet in this last cycle, one of the ballot measures on campaign finance was actually decided that it was constitutional prior to the vote. And I'm curious to know how that happened. I can't remember. We had or was allowed to go on to the ballot. There was controversy when the signatures were collected whether or not it was going to be constitutional. It was decided by one of your courts that it was okay to go on to the ballot.
Judge Landau, do you want to?
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, let me see if this doesn't answer the question. The Constitution imposes certain requirements for getting something on the ballot. Okay, certain things cannot lawfully be on the ballot. That's a different question from whether or not a particular measure, if enacted, would violate some other provision the Constitution, would violate free speech, whatever the limitation is. The courts draw a pretty sharp line between those two different kinds of cases. The courts will decide if any of the prerequisites for getting on the ballot have been satisfied, but the court will not decide before the election whether the measure, if enacted, would violate some other constitutional provision. I don't know the particular case that you're talking about, but that dichotomy is pretty well set in the cases.
Isn't it fair to say, because this confused me too at the time, and it was an ACLU challenge to the campaign finance laws, and maybe the subsequent speakers can speak to it, but the way I understood it is they ruled that it wasn't unconstitutional on its face, but if it went into law and somebody challenged it, the court could then still rule it was unconstitutional. That's the way I interpret it. Oh, I see pained expressions back there.
If there are pained expressions from us, it's that we don't, Madam Chair, we're not familiar with that particular opinion. Perhaps Justice Kistler, when he gets to the podium,
let's put a hold on that question, yeah. Senator Beyer, because I think we're going to hear an answer to that, and that's a very good question. Any other questions for this panel? Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, to address Senator Cruz's issue about do we know about problems, yes. One way or the other, if someone thinks that the Supreme Court interpreted a statute differently than the legislature intended,
well, somebody will tell
we hear that. About it. I assure you the district attorneys will be on the phone or the defense bar, so and at least in this area.
And you will soon hear about it, Senator. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you
so much for having
us. Thank you.
Now my murder crusade against the Oregon Constitution can be revealed here.
More power to you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Reeves Kistler. I'm here with Judge Schumann. And what we want to do is to answer your questions. That's the reason we're here. And the goal, as I understand it, is simply if we can share something that we know about the Constitution that helps you do your job better and write laws in ways that avoid constitutional issues, we've advanced your goal and our goal simultaneously. Let me just introduce Judge Schumann, because his resume is so long, and then I actually want to turn to the question you were asking about. Judge Schumann, let me see if I can get all your credentials in one shot, graduated from Stanford, got a PhD in English, taught English, went back to law school at the University of Oregon, worked as an assistant attorney, worked clerk for Justice Lindy, worked as assistant attorney general, was a professor at the University of Oregon, came back as deputy attorney general, and then on the Court of Appeals. And
got it right.
I intersected with
my entire life in 90 seconds. <it's
enough>. And so I'm very, very privileged to have him be here to talk about the Constitution. My life is much more mundane. I started at Stoll Reeves, as Darian and Matt did. When I was at the Attorney General's office, Judge Schumann had a very nice, small but nice office, looked out over Willamette. I had a enclosed, windowless cubicle that I shared with another person that was much smaller than Judge Schumann's office. And I went on to stay at the AG's office. I got on the Court of Appeals and then on the Supreme Court.
Did you have some involvement with the U.S. Supreme Court at some point?
I did, but that was only in passing.
Justice Kistler was a clerk in the United States Supreme Court to Justice Powell, an honor that is bestowed on the best 5 or 6 law students in the country every year. So he's seriously understating his qualifications. No,
shameful omission.
Well, I'm sorry. And I think what I would like to do more than anything, we had a prepared presentation, which we'll go into, that Bill Taylor suggested various areas you want to talk about, and Judge Schumann was going to lead off, and I was going to cover a couple of things. But let's start. I think what we're really here to do is answer your questions. Let me tell you what I understand about the case you were asking about.
Okay.
Because that was a case that, came up. It would have permitted the legislature or the people to limit campaign contributions, and it conditioned the authority of the legislature to impose that limitation on a two-thirds vote of the legislature. So arguably the issue that was raised initially was, is this more than one amendment? Because it changes the free speech provision of the Oregon Constitution, which at that time had been interpreted or has been interpreted to say there are no campaign contribution limits. And it also changed the way in which the legislature would ordinarily pass legislation. Normally, a simple majority would be enough. This would condition the ability to set a limit on a two-thirds vote. My understanding of why that was permissible before the thing went on the ballot is this. And essentially what Judge Landau said, there are certain conditions to getting on the ballot, like are there enough signatures to make the ballot? And if there aren't, you can raise that issue before the people vote on it, and it simply doesn't go on the ballot. This is a little bit closer, but it's a similar kind of issue. That is, if it has more than one amendment, as the courts interpreted Article 17, Section 1, you can't submit something that has two amendments, two constitutional amendments, to the people as a package. You need to break them out. So the fight was close to the idea of, is this the kind of thing that is qualifies or is eligible just to be put on the ballot? If it had passed, and I can't remember.
It did not pass. This was the constitutional amendment.
Yeah, and one piece passed and one didn't.
The statutory.
Yeah, statutory passed. And so there may be some issues there. But the if it had passed and someone then contended that it was substantively unconstitutional, that the measure itself, because it had been part of the Oregon Constitution, violated some United States constitutional provision, then that challenge would have come up later.
But what you're saying is it would have had to have been a different constitutional challenge. It couldn't have been an Armada challenge.
Well, yes and no. You can bring an Armada challenge both before and after. You can only bring a substantive challenge after. So, actually Armada was one in which the measure passed, and after it passed, maybe 5 or 10 days before the governor signed it, I believe the Armada brought the challenge to Measure 40 and said, you can't do that. You passed it incorrectly. And I think it's always usually permissible to bring a post-enactment challenge. And you get to bring, I apologize for being not completely clear. You can bring a pre-enactment challenge on the qualifications, because if you're right, you keep it off the ballot. The reason you don't usually bring a pre-enactment challenge to the substance is that if it doesn't pass, it doesn't matter. In other words, say you think that what someone wants to put on the ballot violates the Equal Protection Clause. You think, well, this would just, if you enact this thing, it will violate Article 1, Section 20 of the State Constitution or the Equal Protection Clause of the Federal Constitution. Well, the answer the courts usually give is, well, we don't know if it's going to pass or not, and if it doesn't pass, it won't matter. So we aren't going to decide that substantive challenge. But when you say this isn't the kind of thing you can even put on the ballot because it doesn't have enough signatures or it is in an improper form, then that actually has a consequence, and the courts reach that.
Because that's a matter of dispute. Somebody says it qualifies, somebody says it doesn't. Isn't it true that you couldn't bring a substantive challenge early on because you don't have you don't have a case?
Exactly, and because if it doesn't pass, you won't have any things you have to worry about.
So the substantive challenge generally alleges it to an initiative that the people have done something. The people have done something. They voted for something that they're not allowed to vote on. Mm-hmm. A pre-passage challenge. Always, you'll notice these cases are always called Armada versus. Well, I guess that was Armada versus Kitzhaber. But generally, they are the defendant is Secretary of State, and the allegedly illegal action that has taken place is that the Secretary of State has certified for the ballot something that doesn't meet the formal requirements for an initiative. Either it makes two or more changes to the Constitution that aren't closely related, or it's a revision instead of an amendment. If it's a revision, it has to have been referred by the legislature, two-thirds vote in each chamber. So those are much more procedural challenges to the form of the proposed initiative to decide whether or not the people get a chance to vote on it. After they voted on it, then you can challenge their authority to have done what they did. I don't know if that helps or not.
To have put it on the ballot.
No, to have enacted it. To have enacted it.
Yeah. In other words, say like there's...
To the voters? No, wait. How does that work then? Without a case at hand?
No. After it passes, then you challenge and you say, well, the voters passed something that's outside of, it violates some provision of the United States Constitution, it violates the Equal Protection Clause, et cetera, et cetera.
Without a case?
No, you've got to have a case. Yes, you always have to have a case.
And say like the law that passes says something like you should segregate schools. You should have separate schools for different races. Then if that law became, if the voters voted for that and it passed, someone would sue the superintendent of education, the person who was charged with enforcing that law, and say, gosh, you can't do that. That violates the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution. You'd have an easy win. But until that law passes, when they say it's just, say it gets on the ballot and gets enough signatures to qualify for the ballot, you say, well, gosh, in the back of your mind, say you hope the voters won't pass it, but you don't know whether it will or won't pass, so you're not going to go ahead and reach the constitutional issue of whether or not, if you passed it, you could sue the superintendent of schools and say you can't enforce that. That violates the Equal Protection Clause. But if you had multiple amendments put together or not enough votes, you could sue the Secretary of State and say, hey, you can't, that doesn't even qualify for the formal requisites of getting on the ballot.
I see.
And I think that's how it breaks down.
It's a very tricky distinction. Does that answer your question, Senator Barr?
It does, Madam Chair, and what brings up to me is that in the future, and I don't know, was that a Court of Appeals decision, or was that a Supreme Court decision, or?
It's both. There was the Court of Appeals reached the issue and said it had two amendments in it, and disqualified it from directing the Secretary of State not to put on the ballot. They're the ones that talked primarily about whether it was appropriate to reach it in a pre-enactment challenge. It came up to us on about a 7-day time frame, because we had to get it done in maybe 14 days, in order to have the Secretary of State, if we disagreed with the Court of Appeals, put on the ballot. We went ahead and reached the merits, didn't talk as much about whether it was appropriate, but certainly assumed it was, and reached the merits, and said it was simply, the things were closely related enough that it was permissible to go on the ballot, and then it goes. So there are actually two decisions, but the one that discusses the issue primarily is, I believe, the Court of Appeals opinion.
Well, it seems to raise the, or lower the bar, maybe, for any constitutional amendment from now on, that anyone could challenge a constitutional amendment prior to ballot.
Yeah.
On the Armada.
Well, it's been that way for a while, and people do it. It's part of the strategy involved in the initiative process. One side or another will want to delay things, so they'll file challenges, and that's just, it's part of the system now.
But it seems that those challenges used to all be filed on ballot measure titles and those issues prior to signature gathering. This is the first one I recall that being after the signatures were certified, it was challenged on Armada.
There's been a growth to that industry since Armada itself. That's quite true. Mm-hmm. Quite true.
While we're on Armada, and I apologize if you...
No, this is good. I apologize for not being formal. I should say, Madam Chair, this is good, but please.
While we're on Armada, before the Armada decision was decided, I mean, that was such an extreme example. I mean, I was on judiciary at that time when we basically repassed out to the voters the contents of the victim's right measure, which led to the Armada decision. And there were seven separate issues, and I believe we referred six of them.
Mm-hmm. Five, something like that.
Yeah, and some of them didn't pass. Some of them did pass. Actually, I think it was nine of them, and we referred eight.
Yeah.
Anyway, there are a whole bunch of measures involved. But before that, it was, many lawyers told me that it was just, it was openly ignored, the fact that people would put constitutional amendments on and they would pass. One of the examples they gave was the creation of the Court of Appeals, which was quite some time ago. And I know you have a terrible conflict of interest on that particular measure, but there are a lot of other measures, whether you're talking about Measure 5 and of course, term limits fell under Armada, but that was a fairly recent thing. I think the court reached back maybe 5 years to get to term limits. Has the court set any kind of guidelines on how far back they would entertain an Armada challenge?
Well, that's currently an issue that the Supreme Court is dealing with in the challenge to. It's actually not a challenge directly to the Court of Appeals. It's a challenge to Article 7 amended of the Oregon Constitution, which was passed by the people by initiative in 1810, I believe. And the people who are challenging it say that under the standards that the Oregon Supreme Court articulated in Armada, Article 7 amended of the Oregon Constitution is unconstitutional, and therefore the entire existing judicial system is unconstitutional. We would have to go back to a Supreme Court with five justices and no lower courts if that's the case. So the trial court in that case, or one of those, there's a number, that issue is percolating up in a number of cases, and it has not yet been decided by our colleagues across the street. When that case comes to us, when those cases come to us, we take advantage of the procedure that allows us to certify a case going straight to the Supreme Court, so we don't have to determine the lawfulness of our own existence.
Although,
the buck doesn't even slow down here. Is that what you're saying?
On the other hand, it's.
Yeah, and I think that is currently before us. And as I understand it, one of the issues is whether or not there is something akin to ratification where a provision has been part of the Constitution for a number of years and built on and developed by other, perhaps, amendments to the Constitution or the legislature. Whether that is sufficient or not is something that we have yet to find out. I think we have not addressed it. The last time it came to us, we found that it was persons were barred by claim preclusion from raising that issue because they had an opportunity to raise it previously and had not. I think there is a case, as Judge Schumann said, there is a case presently in front of us, and that's one of the issues.
It is definitely
a very significant issue, and I think.
Well, it is, and you know, there's the 1810 case, and then there are the 1970s and 1980s, you know, potential cases. So it's going to be interesting to see how this evolves.
In my memory on the
case, because we weren't even a state in 1810.
That's true. I'm sorry. I meant to say 1910. But it was after. It had to be after the initiative process, obviously.
You know, and my memory of the term limits is that there was a specific provision by the legislature somehow that said there wasn't a sort of time period or a sort of typical thing where you say it's been too much time, you can't go back and challenge it. So the term limits, I think, that issue wasn't presented in that case.
You know, I think you're right. I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, and I think that at least, you know, so that was the one with the longest sort of gestation period. Mm-hmm. And I think that one wasn't, there was that kind of exception. Now, that doesn't mean things one way or the other, but it doesn't mean that by going back and picking up whether the validity of the term limits are valid, the court necessarily was implying you could go back a certain amount of time, or perhaps doesn't mean that.
Thank you for reminding me. That was our action, and I had just flat out forgotten that. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, a little more recently, and back to the last election and what Senator the initiative Senator Beyer was talking about. There's a couple things about that scenario and the cleverness of the people who put those things on the ballot, because the constitutional provision had passed, then the statutory provision was enacted, but which is clever in and of itself. But what truly bothered me was the constitutional provision allowed the legislature to change the Constitution without a vote of the people. And is there a problem with something like that?
Judge Schumann?
there are very straightforward and strict requirements for how one can amend the Constitution. The amendment has to pass in both chambers, and it has to be referred to the people, and it has to pass in the next general election.
But this reversed that.
Yeah.
So it might have not, even if it had passed, it might have not withstood a challenge to its constitutionality.
Then the courts would have had to go into some of the rules about earlier provisions versus later provisions, more general provisions versus more specific provisions, and it would have been complicated.
Yeah, that would have made some very interesting case law.
But just on the face of it, looking at that, and I said, this is not a good way to do business. So I'm glad the results were what they were. But.
Are there any other questions on Armada related questions before I move to one of the issues
yeah,
I wanted?
Sure. No.
I wanted to discuss, which was the challenges of interpreting initiatives. You don't have legislative history. Many of us would argue that you have the direct opposite of plain language. You have campaigns that sometimes say different things than actually happens. How on earth do you go about interpreting these things?
You know, the answer is you do your best. I think one of the difficulties, I think, with initiatives is, and one of the benefits of lawmaking, is that you have committee hearings. You have a professional staff that prepares the bills. You have people with interest on both sides who come in and say, this is a problem. You need to change this. Gosh, you know, I know what you're trying to get to in your language. I'm talking about your bills. I know what you're trying to get to, but it just really doesn't do what you want, or it has an unintended consequence or a consequence I don't think you intend. So please fix it. And one of the difficulties with the initiative is even if you have a really great idea, you don't have that kind of process where people have a chance to think about what you're trying to do, how you're trying to do it, is there something you don't want to do that this gets to? And I think even in the best of worlds, it's always sometimes hard, which is why you get the statutory construction issues, because you can't foresee everything. But I think there are fewer opportunities for that kind of input. And so what you have to do is you have to take the initiative with the words that people used. You have to look at the campaign. Typically, you know, you'll have the statement in the voter's pamphlet, where they describe what's going on. You look at the statements for and against, and you have to discount them because the people that are against something sometimes will magnify its faults beyond what really are there. And sometimes the people that are supporting it don't always tell you everything that's going on. And you try to take that and try to pull out what the people intended. But it is problematic.
If I could sort of embroider on that a little bit. When the Oregon courts interpret statutes, as Judge Landau explained, there are three steps, and the three steps have to be taken in order. And if the meaning is evident from the text itself and the context, game's over. Mm-hmm. Then you move up the steps, and you move up the steps sequentially, and you only go as far as you have to go. There's a slightly different approach to the interpretation of initiatives. I don't know why there is, but there is. And the courts have told us, the Supreme Court has told us, that you look at the same sorts of things. You focus most primarily on the text, the words that are actually used, but then you can look at what are the analogs to legislative history, which is, Justice Kistler pointed out, our voter's pamphlet statements, newspaper editorials, surrounding historical circumstances, the whole universe of things that are out there to help you figure out what the people meant. And then if it's still a tie, you can begin to invoke some of these statutes of construction. But you don't have to do it in any sequential order. You look at all of the things and deploy the interpretive strategies that you want to use and you can use and that are helpful, not necessarily in any order.
Do campaign materials fit into that category, into the same category as voter pamphlet statements, and if so, where? Are they equal, are they lesser, or are they not considered?
I think campaign statements are pretty much the same as sponsored voter pamphlets statements. The neutral statement in the voter's pamphlet is, generally speaking, a better source.
No, I'm talking about direct mail, television ads, the paid campaign.
That will sometimes be considered.
Yeah. But that has a lesser standing to the voter pamphlet, explanatory statement of the sponsors, et cetera.
Yes.
I think so. You know, and I think if you think about a political campaign, sometimes when you have a campaign, you will paint with a broad brush.
No.
And if it's your opponent, not with a nice brush.
No.
and so you have to. So when you're looking at what people have said, you've got to go, okay, how much weight should I give it? It's like, you know, which of your friends should you trust and how much should you trust them? Which ones do you feel are reliable and accurate descriptors, and which ones And some of it, but it's interesting. You just have to sort of evaluate what kind of weight is out there and how much, you know, to pay attention to it. So I think that you just have to put them in the right perspective. And that's not very helpful. But I think you can discount some if you believe they are more politically motivated, not an accurate descriptor of what's going on.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as it relates to initiatives and the wording, one of the bills that the Attorney General, the Department of Justice, pre-session filed, that's in the House, would either strongly urge or require that people going to the initiative process be able to use or have to use Legislative Counsel's office in drafting.
That's a step.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
When I was in the Attorney General's office, about that. There were similar measures, and they were generally opposed by the initiative sponsoring people.
Yeah. Now,
what else can we tell you?
Your counsel suggests you might wonder about Article 1, Section 8. I don't know if you wanted to know about Blakely, if you wanted to know about constitutional issues generally or the constitutional structure. And we wanted to, we have some prepared remarks, but we didn't want to go, we wanted to hit the places that you felt were important for you.
I think Article 1, Section 8 would be a good one to talk about. That's a free speech provision.
Yes.
In Oregon, and it's unique in the country. And we stumble across that quite regularly, whether it be campaign finance reform or nude dancing or a variety of things. So, take it away.
Okay, well, when Judge Schumann and I had divided these topics up, I had given him most of the topics, but taken Article 1, Section 8. But because he was a former law professor, and knows this area inside out, I hope he will come and help me out. So let me start and then tell you, you know, as you know, there are two constitutions. There's the federal constitution, which sets the floor, and nobody can do anything that the federal constitution says you can't do. So the First Amendment sets the minimum that every state has to provide or permit for free speech. Article 1, Section 8 is our free speech provision, and it is more protective as a general matter than the First Amendment. Not always, but as a general matter, it has been interpreted that way. The one piece to me that seems to distinguish it in some ways is something that comes out of State versus Robertson. So I want to talk about that really briefly. Then I want to sort of talk about two sort of tweaks to that happened in one case called Stoneman, another case called Cinquinelli. And I think that what our free speech provision says is different than the First Amendment is that when you draft a bill and you're concerned about the harmful effects of speech, what you need to do is to prohibit those effects and not prohibit the speech itself. And let me give you what's an easy example, I think. Say that people in Portland have been having political parades that have resulted in all sorts of traffic congestion. One thing you could do is say, no political parades. That would be written in terms that are directed at a kind of speech. Or no political expression, also written in terms directed at a kind of speech, would be problematic under both the state and federal constitution for a number of reasons. But for us, they say, don't write it in terms of the speech. Don't use speech as a proxy for the harm. Name the effect you want to get at. So under Article 1, Section 8, you should say something like, gatherings that result in traffic congestion. No gatherings that result in traffic congestion. Or if you do that, you can be fined or penalized in some way. Because in that instance, what you've done is named the harm. And if you have a gathering that results in traffic congestion, you can penalize them. And you aren't going after those political parades that don't result in traffic congestion. David?
The example I used to use when I taught this material was the sort of classic, you can't shout fire in a crowded theater. Well, what the statement really says is you can't cause panic by shouting fire in a crowded theater. If you simply passed a law that said you can't shout fire in a crowded theater, that would criminalize someone who shouts fire when there is a fire, or shouts fire and nobody hears it, or it's an actor on stage who shouts fire. That's a statute that's focused. It simply says there are certain words you can't say. Those kinds of statutes are almost completely prohibited under the Oregon Constitution. You could pass a statute that says it is unlawful to cause panic in a theater by, for example, shouting fire. That's a statute that focuses on the harm, even when the harm can be caused by speech. As long as the focus is on the harm and the crime is not made out unless the harm either happens or comes very close to happening, you can say there's an attempt. That kind of statute passes muster, almost always will pass muster under the Oregon Constitution. So it's this basic distinction between telling people what words they can't say, which is verboten, and telling people what harms they can't cause. And even if you're telling them that the harm they can't cause can in some circumstances be caused by speech or expressive activity, you can almost always do that.
So if you could bring in data that show 100% of men who watch pornography go out and molest children, then you could say you could outlaw pornography in that way?
I think that leads into Justice Kistler's second example.
Okay, if you pass a law that said don't watch pornography, okay, you would start running afoul of the idea that you've written it in terms of speech, because under the Oregon Constitution, as we found out in a case called State v. Henry some time ago, all expression is considered equal, so pornography and political expression, at least for the Oregon Constitution, are on a par, and that differs from the federal Constitution, where they say there are certain kinds of speech, like pornography, which is simply not entitled to constitutional protection. Then you get an exciting question of what is pornography, what isn't pornography, and that's always a case-by-case determination. Then you get to a different kind of question, and there are two ways, if you wrote it in terms of speech that used to, you could perhaps be successful in. One was something called an historic exception, because when the court announced in a case called State v. Robertson back in the 1980s this part, don't prohibit the words, prohibit the harm, it said, well, you know, there's some exceptions. That's not always true, because there are some laws that we've had around so long and are so well established at the time they adopted the Constitution, we don't think the framers intended to somehow make them unconstitutional. And they listed things like blackmail, extortion, fraud, perjury. And so they said, well, there's this historical exception. And so for a while the courts fought about whether or not prohibitions against pornography came with an historical exception. And the court said, essentially, no in Henry.
Are you talking about a federal court or state court?
State court. Okay. And because federal courts, you could always punish pornography.
Okay.
There's a case called Stoneman. And in Stoneman, the law didn't involve just regular pornography. It was basically the commercial sale of movies, films, depictions of children involved in pornographic acts or sexual acts.
Real children, not drawn children, cartoons.
And so if you thought about it for a second, the first problem that that law faced was, well, it's written in terms of the picture or the expression, so it's not written in terms that are directed at an effect, at least it doesn't appear to be, but it is instead aimed at certain kinds of expression. And then the court said, well, it's pornography is, you know, there's no historical exception for it, according to the court. And yet the court said, you know, when we think about what we said in Robertson, this is really aimed at a harm. They said, I think the words the court used were, the actual focus of the statute is on a harm, which is because the common sense proposition that a child who was a participant in making this movie is obviously harmed.
So if you're making the photograph or the movie, you are contributing to the delinquency of a minor by definition.
And it's simply, you could certainly prohibit the sexual act and for the protection of the child.
And furthermore, if you're possessing that, if you've bought it commercially, you are indirectly helping its creation.
And that was only a few years ago, right?
Yeah.
The Stoneman case?
I think, you know,
90,
well, it seems to me a few years, it may be about 10, but that's...
We passed the statute after case came out on child pornography.
And I think, and the theory was, one of the things the court said was there's 100% harm, there's 100% correlation between having a child be a participant in the movie and having the child be harmed. Mm-hmm. And that was enough to convince it, along with some other things, that even though the statute was written in terms of speech and said you can't have this kind of speech, and it didn't come with an historical exception, it still was good enough to pass muster. Now, the one question that I think is hard about Stoneman is it's asking a court to go back and say, well, what was the legislature's actual focus? What were they really concerned about? Which is always a kind of a tougher question. And you have to look at a lot of different clues to gather that. The other thing, and it's unclear to me, is how much there had to be a 100% correlation between the act and the production of the movie and the harm. And it was in some ways easy in Stoneman because I think very few people would dispute that having a child be a participant in the movie is a harm to the child.
Yeah, it's my recollection, after that case came out, we changed the statute to focus on the harm.
Yeah.
And to make that clear.
To address your question, Madam Chair, it has been suggested, and I'm not commenting either way about whether or not I would think that the suggestion is correct. Yeah. It has been suggested that the legislature could pass a statute saying it is unlawful to contribute to the abuse of women by producing pornography. In that case, it has been suggested that if the state could prove that a particular woman had been abused because of pornography, it could enforce that statute against the pornographer.
Wouldn't we have an equal privileges and immunity issue on that?
Yes, I'm sorry, I stand corrected. That's actually, Madam Chair, I wanted to mention that's the second time I correctly stand corrected. The first time was when Senator Beyer corrected my date from 1810 to 1910. So let the record show that I do know when Article 7 was passed.
Madam Chair, I get
Pardon?
I've got another committee.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this issue we're talking about will well be before this committee, probably in a couple of months. There is a bill that will be filed in the House, relates, and that it probably cannot ask the judges and justices to comment on it because it may well be before them in a year or two, which will focus on giving very hardcore pornography to kids under the age of 13. Under the age of 17, where it's used for grooming, and hopefully what would be brought before the legislature is the harm that it does, and even giving this material to underage kids, and hopefully we'll bring in expert witnesses to do that.
Was it the court's interpretation that, if it had been less than 100%, would it have been ambiguous then?
I think, they didn't have to worry about that because it was 100% according to them.
Right.
I don't. If it had been less than 100, I think the question would have been whether you were hitting it, whether there was you were getting some unprotected speech and hitting some protected speech in the same bill. And sometimes if a bill reaches too broadly, in other words, say like you've got a bill that says, okay. You can't. I think this is relatively easy. It may not be, but if you, at least as the Court of Appeals says, if you give pictures of nude people to people who are under 18, that's a crime. You could pass a bill that way. And the question would be, well, gosh, that covers somebody who shares a Playboy with his, 17-year-old friend,
or a biology textbook,
or a biology textbook. So you would think, as a sensible person, there are clearly things you shouldn't be able to give to children. You wonder, okay, what about the Playboy or the biology text to the 18-year-old or the 17-year-old?
Or National Geographic.
And so then you start saying, well, gosh, have you swept in some speech that's protected? And have you gotten too much? Because there's another principle that's sort of a backstop, which is a federal principle, and under Article 1, Section 8 of the state constitution as well, which is that if you pass the first hurdle, which is written in terms of effect, but it has speech as an element, you've still got to make sure it's not doesn't sweep in too much protected speech and kind of like just reach some things it shouldn't reach. And that's the issue, I think, when you start doing that. And so that's the problem you face when you go outside that 100% level.
Let me give you, please. I'm sorry, I jumped right in.
No, I actually welcome it.
I'll give you an example from a case. The issue was, actually this is sort of the fountainhead case of Oregon free speech law, Robertson. The issue was whether or not the legislature could make it a crime to instill fear in people, to make them do something by instilling fear in them. And what the court said was, well, that's overbroad. We understand what you're talking about. You're talking about holding a gun to someone's head and saying, you know, give me $5 or I'll shoot you. But what about the physician who says to the patient, you better quit smoking or you're going to die?
Or what about every parent in Oregon?
that's right. Wait till your dad comes home. Or the politician who says, if you vote for my opponent, you'll probably lose your job. That sort of thing. So that was an example. Of something that wasn't that was so far from 100% that it was unconstitutionally overbroad. But in that very case, the court said, if the only kinds of mismatches you can think of where it's overbroad are the occasional bizarre sorts of things, then that's close enough.
What case was that?
State versus Robertson.
And that was when?
1983, I think.
291R, 293R.
Okay. Thank you. You know, we're over time. This has been fascinating. I'm going to give Judge Schumann just a couple minutes. If there's anything on your list that you feel we have a burning need to know, this has been a great discussion.
Well, I will give you the 20-second summary of what I was going to say for 20 minutes.
now I feel terrible.
I was going to remind everybody that a constitution is something at the most fundamental with constitutes. It organizes a government, and you all know that. And then I was going to talk about the various ways in which constitutions imposed limitations on what you as legislators could do. But you are all seasoned legislators, unlike the House Committee, which had several rookies on it. I don't think I would be telling you anything you didn't already know.
Yeah. Well, you flatter us, so we've learned a lot.
Madam Chair, maybe Ms. Taylor could get a copy of,
sure,
of their formal presentation. This has been fascinating. I've really enjoyed this.
Well,
and we can then distribute it, because we do have one rookie.
Well, Madam Chair, and I realize you're about to go, I just want to tell you how much of a pleasure it is for us to be here. It is always a pleasure to talk to the legislature and to be of any help that we can. So thank you very much for having us.
Thank you so much. You've done a real service today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We are, is there any other business from the committee? The committee?
No.
We are adjourned.
Okay.
I'm just about to pass you a note, Jenny. I got a 3 o'clock.